What is up, everybody? It's me, Brandon Tengumba, here with a special simulcast on both Curveballs and Chair Shots and the Bulletcast for an Under the Radar recap of AEW Dynamite. Just me going solo to recap what I thought was a very good show. Did I say Dynamite or Dynasty? I don't remember. This is AEW Dynasty. It's pay-per-view. Full disclosure, may have had a few drinks today. So if I say anything dumb or if I don't sound myself, I'm just going to blame everything on that. Even though, you know, I stumble over my words. I don't know what to say a bunch of the times, even when I'm stone cold sober during these podcasts. But let's jump into it. So AEW Dynasty took place from St. Louis, Missouri in the, what is this called? The Chafe. This is a mouthful here. The Chaffetz Arena. It's a 10,000 seat building for the St. Louis, on the St. Louis University campus, so not where the St. Louis Blues play, so not a major NHL or NBA arena, but they had a pretty good crowd. They kept touting that it was sold out. WrestleTix had it at they had the last count total at 6,300. The setup could go as high as 6,700, so you know, almost 7,000, not a great number for a full-blown pay-per-view, but at this point, at least AEW is selling on a lower level, at least a ticket-wise, because it's better to be in a smaller venue but sell a lot of tickets comparatively to be in a NBA arena that houses 15, 20,000 people and you tarp off half of the venue and it's, you're only, you know, having the same building size or same house size where it's 7,000 people. And I mean, even when I was at Revolution last year at the Chase Center, that's a very big venue. It looked good on TV, but there was a lot of different places that were blocked out. And I think AEW's kind of come to the realization that maybe they should, downsize a little bit on some of these shows. And even on the next show, the next pay-per-view, rather, the Double or Nothing show will take place from the MGM Grand Garden Arena instead of the T-Mobile Arena, which is definitely a good move on their part. It's it's a smaller venue, but still a historically important venue, especially for AEW, because that was the first place that they ran for the original Double or Nothing. But anyways, let's quit meandering, let's quit yapping, and let's continue yapping by going on and covering the pre-show, at least the pre-show that I watched. So there were three matches in total. The first one was Trent Barretta defeating Matt Sydal. This one only went 8 minutes. The first two matches I did not see, but from what I saw, just, you know, straightforward, not super squash match, but obviously a showcase match for Trent Barretta showing his new heel persona. Then we had the other part of the former best friends, Orange Cassidy, teaming up with Katsuyori Shibata. They defeated Shane Taylor promotions of Shane Taylor and Lee Moriarty. That one goes 12:40. Didn't see anything about that, to be honest. And then in the pre-show main event, we had Bullet Club Gold, Jay White, Austin Gunn, and Colton Gunn defeating the Acclaim, Anthony Bowens, Max Caster, and Billy Gunn to unify the six-man ROH titles and the Trios titles for AEW. This one goes 14:45. Did jump in to see kind of the last 50% of this match. It was fine for what it was, you know. This one at least had some sort of storyline build up to it, so the crowd did care for it. I mean, the unfortunate part of this build in general is just Billy Gunn overtaking Jay White in that match they had a couple weeks ago, where Billy Gunn just absolutely destroyed Jay White, and he's just been emasculated, Jay White that is, for a majority of this whole feud when it comes to Billy Gunn. And just because at the end of the day, Jay White pins Billy Gunn does not mean that everything is better. Everything's hunky-dory in the world and Jay White is repackaged and, you know, rebuilt. I don't understand what's going on with Billy Gunn and why he continues to be, not that he has a TV presence, like that's fine, Like, he can go out there, he can do the stuff with the Acclaim, but it's just the fact that he's out there. And even when it comes to his stuff with the Acclaim, he's almost like the Andre the Giant of the crew. He is the big guy. He's the one that's taking the hot tags. He's getting a lot of the shine compared to the other two younger guys. And Max Caster, I believe he's on the verge of some sort of heel turn. And with them losing the titles, it kind of frees him up to do that. I've seen on Twitter that, I didn't see his rap, but I did see clips of it on the internet. It's getting a little bit of flack online. You know, his raps have definitely fallen off in like the past year compared to what he was doing early on. But he kind of talked about, let's just say people are angry at him because he was insinuating sexual assault and against Jay White. But I mean, that's just kind of honestly par for the course for Max Caster. I don't know if anything is going to happen of consequence for him. If, you know, I don't know how the raps go, because after the Simone Biles situation, he apparently had to run stuff by Tony. So maybe this was run by Tony. I don't know. But anyways, let's get into the pay-per-view proper. It started off with a dream match of sorts. Not the dream match on this show, but a dream match with Kazuchika Okada defending his AEW Continental Championship against Pac. This one goes 21-55 and Okada retains. They had Jim Ross on the call for this one. I think they did a pretty good job at kind of, AEW has done this in the past of kind of going through and cycling all the different announcers that they had. They kept the core of Excalibur being there, being the main play-by-play. JR came in for this match. Taz was the third guy. And they cycled, you know, I'll talk about them throughout the show on who cycled in. But, you know, the rest, Tony Schiavone, Taz, Nigel McGuinness. And they had some side commentators, you know, special guest commentators like Stokely Hathaway and Don Callis. But this was just JR, Excalibur, and Taz. And this was a really good match. I think it did kind of not fall short of expectations, but it's kind of like these backlash matches that we're going to be getting, you know, in a couple weeks, where it's on the edge of WrestleMania. You know, a lot of the champions are not going to lose their title on their first defense. And that's the same with Okada. You know, he just won the Continental Crown or a Continental Championship from Eddie Kingston. You know, he's not going to drop the title to Pac in his first defense. So the finish was kind of a foregone conclusion. But I did think that the work in this match was very good. As I said, it went 21 minutes. So very, very long, at least for like an opening style match. In total, the show, I don't know what the total or when the closing time actually was, but it did go 4 hours. So it was just getting up to the 9 o'clock hour West Coast time or midnight on the East Coast. But this match did go fairly long, and it did kind of, the crowd wasn't very into it at the beginning. Like, they liked both guys, you know, they popped for their entrances and things of that nature. But I feel as though maybe they felt the same as me, as where the build was almost non-existent. It's just kind of a match for the sake of having a match, and everyone kind of knew that Okada at the end of the day was going to win this. But credit to both guys. They got the credit into it towards the end. Okada teased doing the Rainmaker pose, but instead of, you know, putting his arms out, he flipped off the camera. And I don't know if that's going to be his new thing, if this was a one-off, you know, if that's him stopping the Rainmaker pose altogether. So we're going to have to continue on to see if he teases that or just continues to do the middle finger in general. But finishing sequence, we had Pac trying to go for the red arrow. Okada dodges it or puts the knees up or something like that. And then Okada hits the Rainmaker for the win. You know, really good match. Hot start to the show. And it kind of kicked it off on a very positive note. Then second match, we had a trios match of Adam Copeland, Eddie Kingston, and Mark Briscoe teaming up to take on the House of Black, Malakai Black, Brody King, and Buddy Matthews. This one goes 17:45. Another long match. I think if you're trying to trim a lot of the fat on this show, and if you're trying to get from it to be on the cusp of 4 hours to possibly a 3 hour or 3.5 hour show, I would definitely say this was the match to cut. Not that it was a bad match by any means, but you know, this was kind of a collision based match. It was, you know, the has a lot of names on it. You know, Adam Copeland, people love, Eddie Kingston, people love, Mark Briscoe, people love as well, in the House of Black. When they're on TV, which is kind of rarely at this point, the crowd does get into them, and This was a fun match as well. You know, some fun spots back and forth. They had Mark Briscoe set up a chair on the apron, but right by the post, and he kind of did a slingshot tope over the corner post onto Brody Lee in a little somersault. So kind of like what Montez Ford does, where he kind of leapfrogs over, you know, from the ramp, from the ring apron over the post to his opponent. Mark Briscoe did a little bit of a tweak on that, and I thought that was a fun little spot there. They also did a trio spear with the faces doing it to each person on the House of Black, and I was a little confused by the finish, because at the towards the end they had Brody King and Adam Copeland kind of being the two guys that were wrestling, and I wasn't like super locked into the match, but I was paying, I thought I was paying close enough attention, and I didn't see Malachi Black tag in. But I assumed that Brody King and Adam Copeland were the legal guys the entire time. But then just kind of out of nowhere, Malachi Black loads up the mist and blows the black mist right into Adam Copeland's face. And he gets the pin. I saw a tweet out there. I don't know if this is legit or not, but it was four bumps, black mist, get the pin, you know, blown up. So, you know, the narrative on Malachi Black in his AEW run is that he doesn't do jobs, and this does feed into that here in this one, where he, you know, beats Edge. He doesn't do a whole lot, which was the fact. I mean, for the most part, I would say Brody King did a majority of it, and then it would be Buddy Matthews, then Malachi Black is the, you know, kind of a distant third in that realm when it comes to like working in the match for House of Black. So, I mean, throughout the match, they were definitely teasing a Copeland and Black match throughout. Like, they were kind of teasing them interacting, but never full blown head to head throughout. And then with the finish with Black misting Copeland, obviously this sets up a TNT title match for them, whether that's like on a Collision or Dynamite, or they maybe try to build that up all the way to Double or Nothing. We'll have to wait and see, but it was a fun match, but as I said earlier, a match that didn't need to be on the pay-per-view card if you're trying to trim it down. Then we had our first women's match of the night with a House Rules match for the AEW TBS title, Julia Hart defending against Willow Nightingale. Willow's stipulation was that both Sky Blue and Chris Statlander were barred from ringside. We did have Stokely Hathaway on commentary for this one. Then going back, JR tagged out and Tony Schiavone came in after the first match, after the Okada match. He came in and did the rest. No, he did basically the rest of the show, but then main event, JR came back and replaced Schiavone on the card. But first women's match, Willow pins Julia Hart to be the new TBS champion. This one only goes 6 minutes. Honestly, felt a little bit longer than that. Not that that's a bad thing. I thought they had, you know, some good exchanges back and forth. Crowd was relatively dead for this one, kind of, to be honest. They did show Mercedes Moné backstage watching this on a monitor, and it was almost like the most WWE thing ever, where she was watching on the monitor and the monitor was at a 45 degree angle and then she was at like the opposite 45 degree angle, and it was just like, no one watches that, no one watches a television like that, so why is she doing that? And I don't know if that is on purpose or just her being oblivious, but nonetheless, but obviously that was kind of the overarching story in this, where Willow is trying to go for the championship, but the Mercedes is kind of waiting in the wings for whomever is the champion coming out of this, and Willow wins. Yeah, as I said, wasn't the best match, probably the weakest on the card, but at 6 minutes, it was by far the shortest. I mean, this one's six. The second shortest match on the main card, at least, was 15 minutes. So much, much shorter than anything else. And it, I mean, I'm not mad at it, because as I said, the show went so long that you could take off some, you know, a couple minutes from other matches and put some extra on this, but the crowd, there was really no crowd heat for this. So even putting them out there for like 9 minutes might've just been destined to failure. So, I mean, it was perfectly fine. Mercedes comes out, she does like her whole song, like literal song and dance, faces Willow, and then Willow holds up the title, and they showed the graphic for Double or Nothing that's going to happen, and that's that. I don't know what they're doing with Mercedes Moné. Like, she comes in, she had that, you know, fantastic reaction from Boston, and then after that, she just continues to do her little dancey dance, does some very weak promos. They're setting up this Willow match, which is going to take place in late May, so it's going to be 2 months before we see her wrestle in AEW, and I just don't agree with that kind of introduction to her. I think it's just cooling her off, and I mean, I even said this when she came in. Her ring entrance has the CEO chants piped in, so it has the crowd, you know, it has a crowd noise in the background, and they do that, obviously, to kind of tempt the crowd to go along with the CEO chants, but in this one, like, you can see in the crowd, they were not chanting CEO with her. Like, maybe there was a few there that were doing it, but it wasn't overwhelming like it was in Boston. And that's not a good sign for her. And I don't blame the crowd. I don't blame the people in the audience, because she has not shown anything that would make you want to care for her. Like, she's just kind of there, and her character is almost like, cheer me because I'm a star. Cheer me because I'm the CEO. Why should we, like, frankly, give a shit about her, and why we like need to care that much? And I'm not saying we, you know, might be a little inebriated, but I'm not saying, like, you know, fuck her. What is she doing this for? But it's just like, I feel she should be out there wrestling some matches and getting herself over doing that instead of going out there and doing what she's doing, because it's so boring, it's so repetitive. And what, it's the 26th of May, so four more Dynamites and Collisions, or mainly Dynamites, she's been on thus far. So yeah, I don't know. I would not be shocked once we come to that Mercedes and Willow match that it kind of just dies a slow death, because it's going to be given time. It's going to be probably one of the marquee matches on the show. Wouldn't be shocked if it's the marquee women's match on the show over the women's world title, whoever Toni Storm is facing. But yeah, we're just going to wait and see on that front. Then we have the AEW International Championship. You know, this isn't a Battle of the Belts, but in AEW, where everyone has a fucking title, it pretty much is Battle of the Belts, where every match is for a title at this point. But we got the AEW International title with Roderick Strong defending against Kyle O'Reilly. This one goes 17-20, another ambitiously long match. And I thought this was the surprise of the night, like, not in terms of it being a show stealer, like best match of the night, but this was surprisingly a very, very good match. I enjoyed the hell out of this. It was a technical mat classic, as you would expect from these two guys in O'Reilly and Strong. They know the hell out of each other, you know, back in the NXT days. I don't know how much they wrestled on the indie scene at PWG, but I mean, they started off, you know, doing a lot of mat work. I believe it was Taz that compared Roderick Strong to Dean Malenko. I think they do that like almost every match at this point, every marquee match that Strong is in. Then Kyle, really good babyface. He fires up, and he, you know, they just go back and forth and trade a lot of hard-hitting maneuvers. They trade some submissions. And surprisingly, as Tony Schiavone pointed out, Taven and Bennett, they escorted Roderick Strong to the ring, but they did not stay with him at ringside, and so they left. But later on in the match, you know, like the last 3 or 4 minutes, Wardlow came in. He entered the ring. The referee told him to go, and he obliged very nonchalantly. He was like, "Yep, okay, I understand." He just walked out. Didn't walk out in terms of going to the back, but he stayed at ringside and didn't interfere whatsoever. And then Strong, story of the match was shocker that Roderick Strong, the king of the backbreaker, worked over O'Reilly's back, and he wins with a backbreaker to secure the victory. As I said, solid match. I thought this was really well executed, and I very much enjoyed the hell out of this. Probably my favorite match to this point, mainly because I could see O'Reilly winning, even though my pick was Strong at the end of the day. But they, you know, told a really good story, had a lot of good near falls kind of towards the end, and it was just a fun time. It was kind of the start of kind of the second half, you know, kind of the intro to kind of the second, at least not second half, but kind of maybe the second act of the night where it was starting to kick up a notch. You can, you know, get almost, you know, shift a little bit in your seat and get ready for the bigger matches that you know are coming up relatively soon. Then after the fact, we had Taven and Bennett wheel out Adam Cole on the ramp. He shakes his ankle out a little bit, and then he stands up from his wheelchair, probably gets the biggest pop of the night, and he saunters down to the ring. So presumably Adam Cole Bay Bay is at least, if not 100% healthy, healthy enough for him to showcase that he's healthy. So that's a very good sign for AEW. Despite the internet telling me that Adam Cole is nowhere near ready, I don't remember who reported that. I don't want to say any names, but I wouldn't be shocked if it's from the Wrestling Observer. Let's see, Adam Cole ankle status. It might get flooded with kind of new updates from today, but let's kind of see. Click on the news. This was from 4 days ago. This one's from 411 Mania, but who are they? Probably, yeah, Fightful Select has updated AEW star Adam Cole, who has been on injury in recent months after suffering ankle injury. According to reports, Cole is not close to returning to the ring anytime soon. Now, you know, just because he's walking to the ring doesn't mean he's clear to compete, but it's a very good sign that he's at least walking on that ankle. And if you're going to show, like, if you're going to go through all the effort to bring him out there and then have him walk to the ring, you better have him relatively close to returning at this point, because AEW has a, you know, I think they do have some issues with kind of some top stars. And Adam Cole, as much as I really like him, I don't know how he's going to work as a heel, because he's just so talented. And it's like Okada, to an, like, pretty much the exact same way. People cheer for Okada when he does his entrance, when he did the whole flip off the crowd doing the Rainmaker pose. We did get a fuck Okada chant, but it really rings hollow, because it's not as, like, it's not like Dominic or, you know, Don Callis. It's where people, like, you can clearly see they're really getting into it. Not like it's real heat, like it is, like, from the 70s or 80s like that, but people are buying into the characters and they're booing them because they are wrapped up in the story and they're like, oh yeah, we really don't like this guy, we're going to boo him and have a good time doing it. No, they're just kind of booing him because in the moment that's what they want to do, but at the end of the day, if you ask them, do they really like that guy, they're going to say yes. And I feel like that's the thing with Adam Cole. And Cole gets into the ring, and the entire Undisputed Kingdom is celebrating with Strong and very, obviously, not AEW, not very good with subtlety on this one. They zoom in on Wardlow, and you see Adam Cole staring a hole right through Wardlow's back. Wardlow cannot see Cole, but we can see Cole and how he is looking at Wardlow, and even the commentators pointed that out. So no clue when Adam Cole will return, whether it's in 2 weeks or 2 months, but they're definitely going to go down the road of Cole probably turning on Wardlow or Wardlow turning on Cole. And I wonder what is going to come out of this, because Wardlow and Cole, on the surface, that would mean Cole is going to kick Wardlow out of the Undisputed Kingdom. So does that mean Wardlow's the face? But everybody, especially an AEW crowd, is going to cheer the hell out of Adam Cole. So but then are you going to break this faction up so quickly when it really didn't even get off the ground? So it is kind of a mess at this point that they're going that heavily into, whether it is a breakup or a splintering of Cole Wardlow, I don't know. But just, I can kind of see the cracks in the Undisputed Kingdom forming already. And I just don't know how they kind of make that work to where it's not a calamity, but I honestly, I think the best thing to do is just have Cole get out of this. He can go back to being a babyface. I get it. You don't want to give him the Jericho or Big Show treatment where he's turning back and forth all the time. And AEW does have an issue with having people turn way too much. I mean, well, maybe not people themselves, but just having way too many turns kind of all the time. And Cole is best suited as a babyface. Wardlow, I think he's probably best suited as a heel. MJF is still out there in the ether, But if MJF, when MJF comes back, he's going to have to feud with Cole. And when Cole was doing that, he was a full-blown heel. He turned on him. He did the whole devil thing. So I, like I said, once you kind of like get down into it, kind of think about how all these kind of moving pieces are going to fit together, they kind of don't. But that's AEW's problem. That's Tony Khan's problem, not mine. Then we had you guys ready for this? Another championship match, as this was not a sanctioned AEW title match, but it was a FTW title match, as Hook defends the FTW title against Chris Jericho. FTW rules, so a hardcore match. This one goes 16:30, very ambitious for Hook to be going this long, and I thought it was a solid match. It wasn't on the same level, I thought, as Strong and O'Reilly, but if you're going to kind of tier the matches on this card, at least on the main card, it probably goes in like the third tier or maybe like the second tier. It's like very on the cusp. I think it was a good match, but it did not need to go this long. 16:30, not that it's too long for Hook, but just kind of in this point of the card, they just kind of went through the motions. Hook doing a lot of suplexes, Jericho kind of plotting, doing his stuff, getting his shit in, as you would say. And I think the main takeaway from this show, or not the show in general, but this match specifically, is that the crowd did not like Jericho, and they kind of had to rush into this Jericho turn, I think, before they wanted to. Like I said, I think they wanted to like make the turn happen on this show, and you could see the turn coming last week in that segment with Taz and Hook. And then in this one, we had Jericho hit two Judas effects on Hook. Hook kicked out of both of them. The commentators pointed out that John Moxley, I think, is the only person that's kicked out of the Judas effect. And Hook kicks out of two of them. Jericho had his bat, his metal bat, and he just kabonked Hook. They said on the side of the head, but it was really like the neck or shoulder region. And he gets KO'd. And Jericho wins to become the new FTW champion. And as I said, the crowd was not a fan of Jericho in this match. They chanted, please go home, please retire. I don't know if they said, fuck you, Jericho. They didn't go that far. That was the Okada chant. So a lot of negative Jericho chants, and it's not like the Okada heat, where they kind of boo him for the sake of booing him. And it's not like the Dominic Mysterio heat, where people have a lot of fun booing him. It's that kind of third tier of like the quote unquote X-Pac heat, where, or maybe it's now Jericho heat, where people, whether it's fairly or not, kind of see Jericho as being a leech and maybe staying past what he, you know, hanging on a little too much and putting his name on some of these younger people who the fans believe should be getting their own opportunity, not attached to Jericho. And the crowd very much turned on Jericho in this match. And it was, I mean, a long time coming, to be honest. Like, it really started with those Kylie Rae accusations a couple months ago, kind of around World's End. Because I'm trying to go back to when I went to Full Gear in November. And I don't think that was a thing at that point. So it had to have been sometime in, like, late November, December time. But ever since then, so for the past 4 months, the crowd has really turned on Jericho. I don't know how much that has been from those accusations, because at first it was those accusations, and then it's kind of evolved into kind of just Jericho being like the modern day Hulk Hogan. Like, I'm not saying that, and I don't even think that's an accurate representation, but that's just kind of the meme online that's going around of Jericho being like that. And Jericho, like, to his credit, or, you know, for him, whatever you want to say for him, he is leaning into that. He is kind of trying to say, oh, I'm trying to help you, Hook. I'm doing all these things for you, and you're not taking my advice. And Taz is on commentary, and Taz has done a really good job. I think he's a fantastic commentator, not even discussing, like, the connection, this, you know, with Hook and all the, you know, storytelling that he's done in the Hook matches. I think just in general, Taz is a fantastic commentator, but in these Hook matches, with his son being in the ring in the match, you know, in this match in particular, when Jericho hits him with the belt, Taz sold it big time. He, you know, took his headset off and he goes down to ringside to help Hook, and he's like he's yelling at Jericho, but nothing like super physical, like he's gonna suplex him and do anything like that. But yeah, so you know, they're telling the story of Jericho kind of being the hanger-on, and Taz not liking him. I don't think that's gonna set up a match. I haven't heard anything, but I would presume Taz is done for. I mean, I don't know how healthy he is to do like one suplex, because I would assume if he were to do one suplex on Jericho, that would just get an absolute massive pop, and it'd be a really fun time. But wrapping up on this one, as I said, it was okay. Definitely did not need to go 16 minutes. You could have chopped off 5 and it could have went to under 10 and it would have been perfectly fine. Then we get the AEW Women's World title with Timeless, Toni Storm with Mariah May and Luther. Defending her title against Thunder Rosa. This one goes 15 minutes and 10 seconds. Thunder Rosa comes out wearing it's a luchador mask. It almost kind of looks like Wolverine-esque. And she wore that to the ring. She had a bunch of feathers and bows. Toni Storm comes out, and she enters, you know, with her black and white filter. And then when it goes to color, she's like all whited out. She has like white lace. And she has like kind of the powdery face that kind of the actresses and actors would wear back in like the 30s and 40s to kind of accentuate their skin tone and make them look, you know, pop out in the black and white film. So, this match was it was fine. Once again, crowd was kind of dead for it. I mean, the crowd was dead for it at the beginning, but credit to these two women, which I think has kind of been the case for a lot of like the women's matches in general. Like the crowd enjoys the Toni Storm character, and then when it comes to the matches itself, they don't care too much in ring wise. But Toni Storm is just so talented in the ring that she's able to get the people to care about the matches, and I think this is what happened here. And also Thunder Rosa, she's a fantastic wrestler in her own right, and since coming back from injury, she hasn't exactly hit the stride that I think a lot of people thought she would. And, you know, there's rumblings and rumor and innuendo about backstage politics and whatever the hell else is going on with Thunder Rosa. So I don't know how much that plays into it, but both these women can absolutely wrestle. And they showed that in this one. They go back and forth. You know, story was, it was your standard. Someone sells something, someone sells another thing. But Mariah May gets up on the ring apron to try to distract Thunder Rosa, and then Deonna Purrazzo comes down to ringside, and she cancels out Mariah May. So there's a little bit of a dissension between Deonna Purrazzo and Thunder Rosa going into this one. But baby faces, look at that, working together, putting differences aside for the betterment of wrestling. And Deonna Purrazzo helps out Thunder Rosa. But that didn't lead to the finish, but it was almost the finish. They did kind of a fake kick out there where Toni Storm gets something on Rosa. Storm also pulled out the Texas Cloverleaf. But the finish was a distracted ref, which I don't know what the rules are when it comes to female low blows. But Toni Storm hit Thunder Rosa with a low blow and then hits the Storm Zero pile driver for the win. Enjoyable match. You know, nitpicky, could shave a little bit off of this, but the crowd did get into it towards the end. So, a really good match. Then the match everyone was waiting for, the match that was promoted pretty much as soon as Revolution was done and Dynasty was announced, Bryan Danielson taking on Will Ospreay. And my God, this match absolutely lived up to the hype. You know, we don't do star ratings, but it gets all the stars. It was fantastic. If you have not seen this match, if you have 32 minutes and 40 seconds to spare, I absolutely with 100% recommend you find this match, whether it be legal or illegal, because this match was just phenomenal. Danielson comes out to the ring. Ospreay has a electric entrance. The crowd was just so hot for this. And the crowd itself, as I said, it was like 6,700 going into it, maybe a little bit more with a walk-up, but they were a good crowd up to this point. But then once this match started, they were just absolutely electric and on their feet, and it adds to the match. I mean, when it comes to like match rankings and how I feel about a match, you can do all the high spots and get all, you know, do all the flippy shit and do all the moves and stuff, but it all for me personally, it always comes down to how the crowd reacts. And if you can get the crowd to react big in any which way, and even like if me personally, I don't like the match watching at home, if I see a crowd going crazy for something, I can respect it. And this match was definitely that. And me watching at home, I absolutely loved it as well. And Danielson and Ospreay absolutely fucking brought it. I don't know what their minds, I mean, their mindset was obviously to kill each other and to just absolutely set the world on fire with this match. I don't know if it was like the WrestleMania 25 match with Shawn Michaels and Undertaker, where they were put on in the mid card. And this wasn't mid card, you know, this was third from the top. But I thought maybe they would put this second to last because I think the AEW title match was going to be the main event. So maybe that did rub them a little bit the wrong way that they were not at least the second to last match. But they went out there, had 35 minutes to kill, and they, as I said, absolutely fucking killed it. And it's exactly what you'd expect. You know, Danielson bringing the technical wrestling, a lot of strikes, a lot of kicks. Ospreay, you know, trying to match that physicality with Bryan, but then pulling out some crazy flippy do shit. He did, was it like a tornado from the outside, you know, standing on the top turnbuckle out to the ringside area. Ospreay, like, kind of come to think of it, he obviously kind of did like his regular high flying stuff, but I don't think he didn't bring out like anything super crazy that kind of blew your mind. He kind of just did what he normally does, and both these guys just balls to the wall. I mean going into the match, I thought Will Ospreay was not like a lock to win, but I definitely thought Will Ospreay was my pick to win this match. But there was some points at the end where Danielson hit hit the knee, hit the cross face, that I kind of talked myself ahead to possibly Danielson winning this match. And they did the finishing sequence I thought was phenomenal. Danielson hits the knee, and then he goes back to hit another knee, and he goes to one corner. Ospreay goes to another corner. Danielson fires up. He does the yes chance. Ospreay takes off the elbow guard. Ospreay hits the hidden blade, picks up Danielson for the tiger driver, drops him on his head. I think he hits another hidden blade, pins him 1-2-3 for the win. As I said, I know I'm repeating myself, but it might be the White Claws talking. I love this match. I'm not going to be hyperbolic and be like, oh, this was the best match ever and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, my God, when we sit here and do the end of the year awards, this match is going to be in the conversation. It possibly is going to win that award for the best match of the year. And the only negative, which I will be negative, at the end with the tiger driver, Danielson, he does this all the time, and I absolutely hate it. He goes and he's selling his neck, and he's cussing, and he's pretending or making it look like he like really hurt his neck, and he having paralysis, easy for me and my like seven White Claws to say. But I don't like it when he does that. It takes you out of the mood. They also, I forgot to bring this up, they also did that with the Hook match. So Hook, you know, takes a bat to the head, which you know is not legit, whether it's a gimmick bat or he didn't actually hit them in the head. Because if he did hit him in the head, Hook would have died, or at least had a major brain hemorrhage injury and would have been rushed out of the ambulance, or, you know, rushed to an ambulance, and it would have been this big ordeal. So it kind of takes you out of the moment in that front where it's like, obviously that's fake. Why are we doing this? And I get it. This is wrestling. Everything's fake, and you need to just get lost in the moment. But there's things like that where it's so over the top and just so obviously fake that I just don't like that aspect of things. And that was definitely the case here in Danielson selling. The announcers did the Owen Hart voice, where they were very somber and very serious on the matter. And they showed a replay of the Tiger Driver. And if you've seen the Tiger Driver that Ospreay did on Kenny, was that Forbidden Door? But, you know, last year in their match at AEW, that one looked disgusting. But if you look at the replay with Danielson, he clearly tucks his neck. He hits his shoulders. It's clean. Hopefully, not a wrestler. It looked like he was perfectly fine. But then he sells the hell out of it like he's dead. And Danielson has done this in the past. Not even regularly, even going back to like his ROH days, he loves to kind of sell like that to get people to think. But it's like kind of the boar who cried wolf situation, to where you do it so much people aren't going to believe you, And he does have that history, so there will be people that do believe there's something wrong with him. But I did think, as much as I'm putting this match over so much, I thought that did very much damper the kind of the end of the match, because they did hold on to it a little bit. Ospreay didn't notice, quote unquote, right away what happened, but then once he did, he was, you know, very forgiving and very sympathetic towards Brian. And they just kind of, and this is the case with all the AEW matches, they just kind of have the match, run a video package, and move on to the next match. So we got the tournament ladder match, the tournament final for the AEW tag team titles. We got the Young Bucks taking on FTR. This one goes 21 minutes, 35 seconds. Not a short match, obviously, but very hard for them to follow. And I think you could tell that in the crowd. Crowd is a little dead, a little tired at the beginning. And this was your standard Young Bucks indie, well, not indie, because that's kind of a derogatory term, but just kind of your standard Young Bucks ladder match. Very, very spotty, you know, memorable spots throughout with tables and ladders, and Dax cuts himself early on, so he's bleeding all over the place, and that referee has to attend to him. Dax is the one that was bleeding. Cash did a spot where he does a tope to the outside, and he flies through a table. The announcers, I thought, did a pretty good job on commentary, kind of doing callbacks to their matches, because this is their fourth match, I believe, FTR and the Young Bucks and AEW. So they're doing little callbacks throughout where they're like, oh, this happened to that match the last time. So, like, in the first match, the reason FTR lost to the Young Bucks is because Cash Wheeler went to the top rope, something they don't normally do. That ended up costing them. There was another match where Matthew Jackson had his shoe taken off. So they did that in this match where Matthew was climbing up the ladder, and then Dax takes his shoe off. And Matthew also took a nasty-looking bump to the outside. They had a table set up, and I think it was Dax, or no, one of the FTR guys kind of speared him, but not like Mick Foley Edge spear. He just kind of like shoulder-checked him into the table, and Matthew kind of overshot it, and he went through the table kind of ass first. He sat through the table, and then his head kind of banged up against the barricade. It was against the hard camera, so this was kind of the LED board of the barricade. And they, you know, go back and forth. Then the FTR clears ring. The Dax, I believe, goes up to retrieve the titles, and then a quote-unquote fan in a sting mask jumps the ring, pushes Dax off the ladder. Security pin him up against the southwest corner turnbuckle, take off his sting mask, and guess who it is? It's Jack Perry, the scapegoat. So he gets let off through the crowd, and the announcers are putting it over that this is trespassing and he's going to go to jail or something, even though last time I checked, Jack Perry is like still a part of AEW, even though he's in New Japan. So I don't know. I mean, kind of makes sense why they were going down that route, but it was a little comical that they went so heavy-handed on that route. And then Nicholas climbs up the ladder, grabs the title belts, and wins to become the new champions, the first ever three-time, or is it four-time? Let me just check that. Hopefully the Wikipedia page has they are three times champions. Hopefully they maybe. I don't know. It says three times on Wikipedia, so I'm going to blame Wikipedia if it's wrong. Because there's got, I mean, you know, the Wikipedia people always love to update it as soon as this happens. If you go on Twitter, there were some people who were having some fun with Jericho's name on the FTW championship belt on that Wikipedia site. But once again, stellar match, not on the level of Ospreay and Danielson, but this, they were in a very tough spot, and it was a different match than Ospreay and Bryan Danielson, but I think they did live up to what they could do, and it was very hard-hitting, very spotty, but then also in a good way, and it was relatively short at 20, as you know, as short as a 21-minute match can be, to where it didn't like overkill the crowd. So Jack Perry, as I said, got escorted through the crowd, so he didn't celebrate with the Young Bucks. I would presume we're going to get some sort of explanation on Dynamite where Jack Perry is with the Elite. Well, you're going to get the Young Bucks, Jack Perry, and Okada as the new Elite. And that sets up, well, I don't know when it's going to set up, but that possibly could set up a, you know, new Elite, old Elite. You have like Kenny Omega, Adam Page, maybe teaming up with FTR in like a War Games match, or sorry, Blood and Guts match in July. I think that's when they do Blood and Guts normally. So if Kenny and Cole or Kenny and Page are up for it and healthy, that could be a really fun match. If just fantasy booking, if that's what they want to do. Then main event time. Finally, the AEW World Title, Samoa Joe defending against Swerve Strickland. This one goes 18 minutes. Swerve comes out in a Black Panther-esque garb with a mask and some claws, and then Prince Nana puts a cape over Swerve. He gets kind of a like an entrance before an entrance, and then his Swerve music hits, so the crowd gets to dance with Nana and do all that stuff. And then Joe makes his entrance, nothing special like you would expect with Joe, just a towel and his shorts. Championship introductions from Justin Roberts and a very straightforward match. Joe putting a lot of heat on Swerve. Swerve makes the comeback, hits the stomp, and he gets the win to become the new AEW World Champion. The finish, not that it was botched, but I did wonder if they were trying to go for like a super Swerve stomp, because they did. They were in the corner. Swerve and Joe were perched up on the top turnbuckle, and it looked like Swerve was possibly going to go for a stomp with Joe still on the top turnbuckle. But then Swerve kind of jumped over Joe and then hits him with a powerbomb and then hits him with a stomp for the win. So I don't know if maybe something would have happened with the timing and kind of Swerve kind of did something, you know, made an audible on the fly to where something happened. But regardless, Swerve hits the stomp for the win to become the new and first African-American AEW champion. So shout out Swerve on that front. They were really hammering that home in his entrance that Swerve wanted to be the first black champion or first black AEW world champion. So at that point, you kind of knew that Swerve was gonna win this match. And I mean, even the build up to that point where it's like Swerve's a choke artist, Joe said, and he's gonna choke him out. And it definitely felt as though they were kind of teeing it up for Swerve to win. And that's what happened. It was a solid match. I think it was definitely a step down from the prior two matches. And it was probably to be expected. I mean, the shortest out of the three, Ospreay and Danielson, clearly the, and I think it kind of goes in that order with Ospreay and Danielson being the best, then Young Bucks, FTR, and then Swerve and Joe. Crowd was really hot for Swerve, like in the entrance. And then the match took place and they were just kind of there. I mean, the match itself, it kind of played into the story of Joe putting a lot of heat on Swerve. And so the crowd's not going to get really hyped up for that. And Swerve isn't exactly the babyface, like the Daniel Bryan babyface or even the Cody babyface, where he's going to sell a lot and you're going to really trying to get behind him and he's going to hulk up and make the big comeback. That's not Swerve's character. So maybe that's just par for the course with Swerve in this title run, but it just didn't kind of hit that crescendo that you would think a title, you know, a winning title match would want. And you know, everyone's gonna try to compare and contrast this and the Cody one, and I'm not gonna do that. But it was a really nice moment. I thought Swerve played it perfectly. He's a clear-cut babyface, but he's not like a white meat baby face where he's just like, oh shucks golly, I love all my fans and I'm just gonna try my hardest. He's still the same Swerve that was doing that was intruding on Hangman Page's house and terrorizing Hangman's baby. He's just now getting cheered for it. So I do like Swerve on that front. And it was a good moment, but the match itself was fine. It was kind of the weakest, I would maybe say, of the top matches on this card, but still a phenomenal show. Wrestling wise, really, really good. AEW, as much as we want to shit on them for kind of the weekly television and kind of the lack of ticket sales and all the other stuff. When it comes to the pay-per-views, they always put on classics. And Revolution, they hit it out of the park with a Sting retirement. And this match, this show, build-wise wasn't great, but the matches on paper sounded like they were going to be really good. And for the most part, they all delivered. So in that case, I mean, grade-wise, I probably would give it a... Honestly, I'd give it an A. I thought this was a really fun show. It was paced, you know, quickly, but maybe this is me personally because it does kind of ebb and flow. I didn't feel tired. Also, you know, on the West Coast, starting a show at 5 is different than on the East Coast where you got to start the show at 8 and it ends at 12. So I understand that, but I really enjoyed this show. I thought it was great. Really from top to bottom, nothing bad, I would say, on this card. And, you know, some of the lower tier matches, you could definitely shave off some matches or even cut some matches. Like I said, the Trios match with House of Black, you can cut. Even as much as I love that Roderick Strong Kyle O'Reilly match, like I think you could have cut that one as well. And you can, you know, that's what, 17 plus 17. So damn near 40 minutes with commercials. So you're just past the 3 o'clock hour. And you could have cut it, you know, had a nice tight, just over 3 hour show. And I get it. They want to, if you're paying $50, Tony Khan probably wants to put on a quality show. But then there's that tipping point of what's worth $50 and what's too much. But just like Taz says, I digress. But anyways, thank you guys very much for tuning in for this long show. Did not go an hour. I thought I would, but I did not. And if you haven't checked out AEW Dynasty, I would definitely recommend it. But let us know what you think of the show, whether you listen to this on Curveballs and Chair Shots or you're listening to it on the Bulletcast. So follow Curveballs and Chair Shots, Curveballs and CS on Twitter and Instagram. Follow the Bulletcast, the Bulletcast on Twitter and Instagram, Curveball and CS at gmail.com. Bulletcast number 2, sweet at gmail.com. See, even a couple White Claws in, I can still make perfect plugs, even though I've been talking for an hour straight. I probably have worn them off. But anyways, thank you guys very much. Love you all. Make sure to check into the latest episode of Bulletcast and Curveballs and Chair Shots. New episodes coming out this week where I would assume we'll talk about, well, all the fallout from the show and including the lead up for the WWE draft. So love you guys all. Big hugs, tiny kisses, goodbye, and good night. Bye-bye.